This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we are going to discuss the communist playbook now on this show, and I'm telling you, it is going to be maybe the best special we have ever done. We have Charles Cornish Dale in a couple minutes talking about street communism. Mike Benz is going to join us and discuss NGOs and Antifa and all the other stuff. But before we get to any of that, I just wanted to explain something basic, but it's really important to understand how the communist sees himself and his mission. When the communist revolution first took hold in Russia, which obviously became the Soviet Union when they won, the czars were in power, kings. Look, they're Russians. They just called themselves czars, a monarchy that had lasted for a very, very long time. And the people were out of power. Certainly the communists didn't have any power at all. Now, how do you take down a monarchy? They have all these troops and secret police, and they have all these things at your hands. At their hands. So how do you do it? Well, carefully and quietly. You can't march your troops down the street right away to take on their troops because you will simply be smashed. You don't have the hard power necessary to take down all those troops. So you have to infiltrate. Your revolution involves infiltrating. It has to agitate people. Get the masses rising to your cause. Create dissent. Create disorder in society. It has to be done step by step by step by step. The communist revolution is not a day-long thing. And the communist understands that. It takes years, sometimes decades, for him to infiltrate to a level where he has the hard power and he can finally smash the country he hates so much, which is, of course, always his own. The communist is at war with the entire world. Communists are revolutionaries. They are infiltrators and revolutionaries. They operate in the exact same way everywhere they go, which, of course, brings us to the United States of America, because we look around and we try to process right now what we see. And I understand we have better leadership now with Trump in charge, but it's hard to fully comprehend. Okay, you have Antifa and the Black Lives Matter and the street animal types. You have those. Okay, but we kind of understand that. We'll understand a lot more in a little bit. But then there's the Democrat Party and the media. They seem to speak the same language and almost work with each other. But then the FBI... they work with them too. How do we get to this place? So remember, institutions, they hold up your country. Every country. Doesn't matter where you're watching the show from. They hold up your country. Countries have religious institutions and government institutions and educational institutions and entertainment institutions. These are the pillars that hold up a society. The communist can never succeed in his revolution until he either destroys those pillars or takes over those pillars. At first, they always attempt to simply destroy them. That almost always fails. You want a great example of this? The Weather Underground in the 1970s, very violent communist group, nail bombs, killing people, so on and so forth. What happened? Our law enforcement institutions, our government institutions, which had not been conquered yet, simply reached down and smashed all these things out of existence. Like that, they were gone. That's how it's supposed to work. The communist saw that, got frustrated with that, and so he decided, well, I'll take over those institutions. I'll infiltrate them. Once I infiltrate them, then when we start doing our street animal things, they not only won't stop me, they'll help me. Remember, as you look around in horror at the assassinations, the vandalism, the everything you see right now from the street animals across the United States of America, that the Federal Bureau of Investigation just completed 4 years of infiltrating the Catholic Church and arresting pro-lifers when they weren't arresting Donald Trump, while communist terror rose. I'm going to play you one clip, and just one clip. I know you've seen it a million times before. Barack Obama, as you know, was president for 8 years. He is a trained street communist. He learned on the streets. He learned these infiltration tactics. Barack Obama got elected president, and he was a different kind of a Democrat because the hatred he had for America was mean. He meant it all the way. A born and bred America hater. And he discarded the traditional people you should put into power in government. And he went and grabbed the most vile Maoists he could find, and he put them in positions of power to complete this infiltration. This video is a video of Barack Obama's pastor. He grew up in the pews. Barack Obama, of course, tried to walk away from him later on, but this mentality isn't just in Barack Obama's church. It's in your FBI. It's in CNN. It's in our institutions.
When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America, that's in the Bible, for killing innocent people. God America for treating her citizens as less than human. God America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
That disgusting, demonic mentality is everywhere in our institutions now because they marched. Now, we have to march them out. We'll talk to Charles Cornish Dale in a moment about this. Race, communism, and other things. Next. I'm skeptical. I'm a natural skeptic, I'll be honest with you. And this summer, remember I told you we went to Montana. I was hanging out a lot with my sister who lives up there. And she started talking about colostrum. Colostrum this and colostrum that, and started talking about how great her stomach feels now and how she never gets sick anymore. And I thought to myself, that doesn't sound real. That surely isn't real. But reluctantly decided to, because cowboy colostrum is delicious. There's strawberry and chocolate and vanilla. So what I started doing was pouring a couple scoops of my coffee in the morning. Two scoops in the morning. So I now have chocolate coffee. I've not been sick since. I'll tell you what. The stuff is amazing and tastes really, really, really good. You're going to struggle not to put in three or four scoops. CowboyColostrum.com/JesseTV. Go get some. We've talked a million times on this show about the two different divisions of communism, the elites in the streets. The elites aren't really true believers, but they're trying for money and power. And so they give orders to the violent street animals who go out and march and loot and vandalize things. And we've talked a lot about race communism. This is by far the easiest sell to the masses. It always has been, always will be. It was in the Soviet Union, it was in China, and it is today. You know, white people suck, all this crap you see. And remember, the street animals get away with the things they do because they get legal protection from the elite ones. Remember this stuff?
This man's life matters. He matters. Being black in America should not be a death sentence.
Black lives that are under threat every single day. And I'm glad the mayor of Minneapolis stepped up right away in the police department and took swift action to fire the officers involved, but I don't think that's enough. And I don't think we can move forward unless we take aggressive action to rip out the insidious race-based inequalities that corrupt every part of our society.
I want to be clear in how I characterize it. This is mostly a protest. It is not, generally speaking, unruly.
They are strictly principled anti-fascists, and they've taken a principled stand to stand against white supremacists and white nationalists wherever they may show up.
It says it right in the name, Antifa, anti-fascism, which is what they were there fighting.
Antifa is an idea, not an organization.
Oh, you got it.
Not militia. That's what FBI director
Gentlemen,
said.
Well, then, you know what? No, we're done, sir.
Everybody,
we're moving on to the next. We're moving
on to the next. That's not an idea.
Everybody
Antifa
in your administration tells you the truth has a bad idea.
Can I tell you what?
You have no ideas that are.
Antifa is a dangerous radical.
All right, gentlemen,
group.
We're now moving.
Joining me now, one of my favorites, Charles Cornish Dale. You probably know him as Raw Egg Nationalist online. He wrote a wonderful book, The Last Men. Highly recommend it. Charles, the street animals, they get their orders and they march forward and they do what they do, my brother.
Yes, yeah. That really is the way that it takes place. And I think it's important, actually, to understand that this really is a domestic insurgency that's taking place. Mm-hmm. That was made clear in 2020, and it was good that you showed clips from 2020, from the summer of Floyd, which really, you know, everything that took place during that summer showed the way in which the sort of low-level... The ground, the foot soldiers, the Antifa dudes, you know, the black bloc people on the ground, the way that they essentially actually take orders from political elites, from local political elites, but also from national political elites as well. So, I mean, it really was the case that actually the Democrat Party basically deployed its own paramilitary, Antifa, these Black Lives Matter people and other groups, onto the streets in order to effect what was basically a color revolution in 2020. You know, it was the sole aim was to prevent Donald Trump from being re-elected, and it worked. So we've seen this in action. We know that this is exactly how it works. We know the interplay between these foot soldiers, people on the ground, and the elites, and something's got to be done about it.
Charles, can you explain in your own words why it works? Because to a normal logical person, they see Democrats and their pets assaulting and looting and murdering and destroying things, and they say to themselves, well, people will naturally reject that at the voting booth. That's not what people want. They don't want looting. They don't want burning. People will go out and roundly reject that. But that's not necessarily how it works. Why?
No, it's not how it works. And I mean, I think what you have to understand is you have to understand the success of the left in capturing the culture. They've been doing this for decades. And in fact, actually, they've been doing it probably for about a century. So there was a Marxist theorist called Antonio Gramsci, who was put in prison in Italy in the 1920s. And he wrote a series of reflections on the failure of communist revolution in Italy and in the rest of Europe and the Western world after the success of the Russian Revolution. And he basically outlined a plan for cultural revolution, for what became known as cultural Marxism. And the plan really wasn't anymore to look to the workers, to look to a kind of economic uprising, but actually to infiltrate and subvert all of the dominant institutions, all of the most important institutions in European societies as a prelude to a broader social revolution. And so that's what's been happening for decades. We've had the capture of all of the institutions of government, of education, public services, by radical leftists, and it's borne terrible, terrible fruit. And I think it's produced generations now of young people in particular who have absolutely no clue, have no real mooring in reality. And so, yes, you do get this, you know, this kind of paradoxical situation where you think, oh, of course people will reject looting, they'll reject violence, they'll reject this kind of divisive appeals to kind of racial resentment. But of course they won't, because actually they've been stewed in it for their entire lives, from elementary school through high school and certainly in university, if you attend university. And so I think there's a huge, huge amount of programming now that needs to be broken.
How do we break it? I know Donald Trump famously came out and said Antifa's a terror organization yesterday, and of course I support that and whatnot, but you could go smash up as many Antifa cells as you like if we have legions of young people who've been indoctrinated to think that Western society sucks and white people are the enemy and all these other things. That's a lot of years of indoctrination we have to reverse.
Yes, it is. I mean, this isn't going to change overnight. I mean, this is the left has taken 100 years really to get this far, to capture the major institutions of society, to capture the youth, to create this great indoctrination machine. And so, yes, I mean, this is going to be a multi-year project, I think. I mean, one thing that obviously needs to happen is that we either create parallel institutions, which is what somebody like Christopher Rufo, for example, is doing with great success in Florida, with I think what is it, the New College of Humanities, university like that that's been taken over and that's now being de-radicalized, as it were. But I also think that what needs to happen is that the apparatus of terror needs to be broken up. And that's what's so encouraging, I think, about Donald Trump's designation of Antifa as a terrorist organization. It's the first real sign that actually the American right, the conservatives, the Republican Party, whatever, takes seriously the threat of the radical left as an organized network, as an organized grouping that employs terror tactics, that is funded as well by, you know, billionaire donors, not just George Soros, but lots of wealthy people are channeling money into this leftist terror network, getting it out onto the streets, onto the people who harass, into the hands of the people who harass and dox and ultimately murder people too. So, I mean, I think it's going to have to be a multi-pronged approach. It's going to have to focus on recapturing institutions, but also in the immediate term, right now, it needs to focus on this terror network because, you know, last week, Charlie Kirk was murdered by a radical leftist, and that's not the first murder, and it probably won't be the last either, unfortunately.
Charles, what do the billionaires get out of this? This is one of those psychological things that so many people struggle with. And as you pointed out, Soros is, of course, the boogeyman that everyone knows, and he's very real, but he's far from alone. What? I'm a billionaire. I've got a yacht and a private jet and 10 19-year-old girlfriends, and I'm eating grapes in Greece right now. What do I want to get involved in all this stuff for?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it does, I mean, certainly at first glance, it does appear to go against the interests of the billionaires, but I think fundamentally you just have to think that these people are interested in control. It is a form of control that they derive, from financing these groups. It does allow them political power and influence. But I think there is possibly too. I think there is in some cases an actual ideological commitment too. It's difficult to tell. It's difficult to tell, certainly, a true believer from, you know, just a billionaire who is basically trying to increase his power. But I do think it's there too. But it's a strange question, and it's one that's actually quite hard to answer satisfactorily, completely, because it just doesn't seem to make sense. You know, you'd think, oh, the billionaires, of course. I mean, in classic Marxist theory, then of course it's the capitalists who are against the revolutionaries. But that actually isn't necessarily the case. I mean, I think these people think they won't get swallowed up by the revolution. And as we know, I mean, a revolution almost invariably devours its own children. So they may very well be mistaken in that regard. But I do think that people like George Soros and these billionaires think that they'll be able to keep their wealth, that they'll be able to keep their influence in, some sort of future radical left-wing communist society.
Yeah. generally doesn't work out that way. That's the one good thing you can say about communism. Charles, his book is The Last Men. Highly recommended. Thank you, brother. I appreciate you. All right. These NGOs, Antifa, are you paying for it? Am I? Talk to Mike Benz next. You feel revved up and ready to go. I do. All the time I do. And I didn't 4 or 5 years ago. I used to get home from work and just be crashing, tired, done with the day, counting the minutes till bedtime. Now I feel good. I get home, I want to go for a walk. I want to play with the kids. That's because of Chalk. Chalk has changed my life. Natural herbal supplements will change your life and make everything better. I have 70-year-olds emailing me, telling me they just came from the doctor's office and their T levels are like a 20-year-old. With natural herbal supplements? Go take a male vitality stack from Chalk for 90 days and tell me how you feel. Ladies, you are not forgotten. A female vitality stack for you. The best quality in herbal supplements I have ever experienced in my lifetime can be found at chalk.com/JesseTV. Go get some.
I've always said we follow the money. And whether it's terrorism or a tax based on ideology or a tax on institutions of faith or people of faith, someone's paying for it. And we are reverse tracing those steps. We are not stopping at the perpetrator themselves. We are reverse engineering to hold those accountable in our investigations to who funded them and knowingly funded them. And we will bring the appropriate steps against them with our partners at DOJ.
Okay. Sounds good. Also sounds extremely confusing. This stuff gets very confusing for those of us who don't understand this network, NGOs, the nonprofits, and the Arabella advisors. And how does all this stuff work? Well, there's nobody better to explain this stuff than the great Mike Benz. You're well familiar with him if you watch this show, executive director of the Foundation for Freedom Online. Mike, I don't understand. Follow the money, NGOs. How's this translate into Antifa terror? Can you please explain it?
Yes, I think what Cash is referring to here is the flow of funds that go from the, you know, what they're called non-governmental organizations. Of course, anytime you need to put the first thing about yourself is that you're not something else. That's usually a tell. I don't need to describe myself as a non-governmental individual. I think if I had to say that as the introduction, you'd probably think I'm a Fed. But the fact is you know, these non-governmental organizations, you can think of them as kind of like stem cells. They're stem cells of the political influence world, and they can take many forms. They can be cutouts for government action when the government wants to do something, but it's either illegal or it would be controversial or scandalous. It is farmed out in the same way that the military uses private military contractors for dirty work that they don't want to say was authorized directly by the U.S. government. Governments do the same with NGOs, and so do billionaires and multinational corporations. They will donate to a outside contractor, effectively, in the form of a nonprofit. And what that means is that the nonprofit is simply not making a profitable product or service. Their customer is their sponsor. So they are essentially hitmen for hire. They are contract killers, in a sense, for the sponsors who pay them to do whatever it is they are being paid by the sponsors to do. And when you're talking about these Antifa networks, the networks are juiced by NGO money, by nonprofit world money, by this kind of stem cell-like money. And there's a few ways to look at that in terms of what's in the news now about Trump, his Truth Social post about declaring Antifa a terrorist organization. This, by the way, I should note, is not new territory for Trump. In May 2020, he tweeted out, at the time when he still had his active Twitter during the 2020 election cycle, that he was going to be declaring Antifa a terrorist organization. That did not happen at the time. even though he tweeted that out. And so we have this Truth Social message. We don't know if there's any punch behind it in terms of any sort of executive classification. We're still waiting for details. But what we do know is that these groups that are in the spotlight right now of the FBI investigation, the New York Post reported that that groups like Armed Queers, Salt Lake City, and the like are being investigated right now in the probe into Trump's network for potential coordination or advanced foreknowledge and the like. But these groups are entirely run on NGO money, and that NGO money is downstream of both governments and billionaire, secular ideological and economic interests. And there's a lot we can talk about to move from there, but that's the general structure.
Okay, I want to focus on the money portion of it for a minute. And I asked this question fully knowing that there is a legal firewall that was built on purpose that is going to make a lot of these answers impossible to get. You say there's NGO money that goes to these Antifa terror cells. You said it's billionaire money, government money. What billionaires in which government agencies?
Well, I'll start with the billionaires. Very famously, the Open Society Institute, the Open Society Foundations fund all of these groups to take out threats to right-wing extremism and right-wing. Yeah, these are groups that are effectively pro-democracy groups, ostensibly, or groups to fight authoritarianism, and they define fascism as right-wing authoritarianism. This is the kind of stuff that actually goes back a very long time. I want to lay out a framework, actually, if I have a few minutes here to understand this.
Please.
The role of NGOs in funding extremist movements is not a new thing. In the late 1940s, during the Cold War, the Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S. State Department, and partnered governments in NATO launched something that was called Operation Gladio. And this ended up being substantially declassified effectively in the 1990s after all of these intelligence documents were revealed in court cases in Italy. And many books have been written about this, but this was we had just won the World War II against the fascist governments of Italy and Germany. So the governments of both the United States and NATO allies were not pro-fascist by any sense. But another threat emerged to neoliberal commercial interests in Europe from left-wing communism. And because of the threat of Soviet Union advancement politically throughout Central and Eastern Europe and even into Western Europe, the U.S. government, in tandem with our NATO allies, funded to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars in the aggregate over the decades, what they called stay-behind networks of extreme right-wing groups, what you might call kind of fascist-adjacent right-wing groups that were very deeply anti-communist. Now, the CIA did not fund that because they wanted fascists to take power back. And they didn't fund it on ideological grounds. They funded it the same way they fund ISIS and Al-Qaeda to take out Bashar al-Assad. Many of these front groups, religious organizations, media assistants, paramilitary assistance. This was in almost every European country, there were these right-wing, fascist-adjacent groups who would break up meetings, for example, violently when left-wing communists would attempt to organize, who would crack skulls and crack bones, who would effectively create a climate in which it was very hostile to be a left-wing communist. And this was seen as something that was necessary to support covertly by the U.S. government and NATO, because these were radicals who were willing to take out the, it was like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But it was very deeply organized and structured. There were formal cells, and they were very secretive, like the P2 lounge in Italy and the like, where you had this kind of secret membership. They brought in folks from all walks of the business community, the media community, the government allies, the civil society folks. They structured them into these cluster cells. And that was effective for the Western world to stop the rise of left-wing communism, to contain its rise during the Cold War. What I believe has been going on for the past 10 years, in sync with what has happened with the organized structure of the censorship industrial complex, these very same kind of networks and structures, I believe, have been constructed for the so-called anti-fascist groups to stop the rise of right-wing populism, that were done to help what you might call the fascist groups to stop left-wing communism during the 20th century. What you see is a pattern match. Country by country, Antifa has been violently wiping out and stopping the ability to either organize or host speeches or mobilize or articulate anything at all without getting your skull bashed in Germany, in France, in Spain. These violent, effectively Antifa terror cells are stopping the rise of the blob of the uniparty State Department, Intel, military, and Chamber of Commerce allies. All of their enemies in Europe have had their skulls cracked by Antifa, while all of these Antifa incubator places in the universities, in the media space, in the civil society organizations, in the trade organizations, in the labor organizations, are getting hundreds of millions, billions of dollars of U.S. aid, of pass-through U.S. aid through sub-grants. And we know that structure was done to take out political enemies internationally in the 20th century. We know that structure existed with the censorship industrial complex. I want to know, and I believe that Tulsi Gabbard at ODNI has this power, as well as their comparables at the State Department, USAID, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, and other places. I want to know if we've got an inverse Gladio situation, that the same way NATO feared Brexit, Frexit, it'll exit, Grexit, and these Antifa groups all used violent terroristic force in order to stop events like that from happening. I want to know, if you open up the CIA files at ODNI, who's got oversight over CIA, where these Antifa groups have military-grade OPSEC. Anyone who's been in this space will tell you the unbelievable military-grade nature of the secrecy with which things are conducted, the multiple burner phones, the multiple passwords and vetting to be able to enter closed-door meetings or get access to anyone in the leadership of these things. You look at the very strange following and followed on all of the major Antifa accounts, and you'll see it's riddled with following and followed by very strange figures in the military and intelligence world, while those same groups are taking out the exact targets of folks who belong to those agencies. I believe that if you were to open up the intelligence files and open up the USAID files and open up potentially, I don't know that state would that might be a little bit too spicy for state. It would probably be farmed out to CIA or USAID or USAGM or one of these others. But I believe we have a right to know. This is something that I think the intelligence community will howl and moan about, because it will expose sources and methods, and how will any group around the world trust America again to work with that with their spy agencies if they know that their identities and networks will be revealed if the wrong person wins the election? Well, then you, I was going to curse, but well, then you shouldn't have friggin' weaponized it domestically. You crossed the line. You crossed the line this time. If you wanted to keep this as a global influence operation, then you should not have brought that war home. This is like funding ISIS and then having ISIS terror attacks on U.S. soil. You support this network around the world. These networks that are global mingle domestically. The flow of funds is international. The exchange of ideas is international. When you pump up extremist movements around the world for whatever reason, and even the underlying reason is completely outrageous. It was not a national security threat from the German AfD party. It wasn't a national security threat to the United States if Marine Le Pen became president in France. It wasn't a national security threat to the United States if the Vox party won in Spain. They did it to play politics, which is the last thing you should ever use intelligence for. It's the last thing you should ever use humanitarian relief funds at USAID for. We have a right to know, was this organized? Was this supported? Were these groups used as pawns, as assets, in order to take out political enemies of the state? Right now, we have a declassification power. We could do a WikiLeaks-style, a JFK Files-style, post 85,000 documents, run a keyword search, go into the search queries at CIA, USAID, USAGM, put in the word anti-fascist, see what pops up, and publish everything.
Mike, let me ask you this. How does all this tie into this really bizarre, obviously I'm too old to understand it, online world of darkness where this furry, tranny, weird, ugly world, Discord, I know was part of this. How does all this tie in? I'm sure there's a tie in. I just can't figure it out.
Well, these are channels. So Discord is very popular in the gaming community. It's a very flexible platform and is a very effective tool for content creators online because it allows everyone in the community to have a common channel for sharing their own content that's unique to that community, videos, GIFs. It's also very flexible in that it allows like voice calls, and so it can immediately plug in to allow both text and real-time communication. It's also completely ideologically and institutionally captured by the farthest parts of the far left. As a content creator myself, I've had many, many people tell me, start a Discord. And I always laugh because I think, okay, if I want the... Folks, remember, back in 2007, this started as a gaming community tool because, it was very... the way that channels work and the way that, every video game has its own subculture, and then there's kind of overlap between the social and the entertainment side of it. But back in 2017, Discord, back-end people at Discord were leaking any right-wing Discord chat to a group called Unicorn Riot. In fact, there was a Twitter account called Discord Spies, which would publish effectively what people thought were secure communications on the platform because it was just leaked. The back end trust and safety folks and folks behind the content moderation team would just straight up give any conservatives private chats to violent Antifa groups, and that would be used to dox everybody if they were on an alternate account. It would be used to dox their IP address and their location, and these people would be terrorized. So Discord has been one of these extremely captured platforms, and it has marketed itself in a certain respect because of those subcultures to these very far left elements. And among them, you have this kind of Antifa, Trantifa type community where you have essentially pawns of billionaires or intelligence agencies or entrenched political interests love crazy people. They love crazy, stupid people who are who have what they call a high risk tolerance. I'm just quoting the U.S. Institute of Peace, the U.S. government agency that we give tens of millions of dollars to every year. They recruit what they call high risk tolerance individuals, people who are willing to get arrested. It's a direct quote from the founder of the Program on Nonviolent Action at the U.S. Institute of Peace. People who are willing to get arrested, have a high risk tolerance, willing to block streets and roads, willing to commit property destruction. This is defined as part of the civil resistance nonviolent action toolkit, because they say that if you light a police precinct on fire or you burn down someone's house, that's technically nonviolent action, they call it, because they simply define violence out of it by saying, well, it's not bodily harm. No one died in the process of me lighting this police car on fire, and so it's nonviolent, just like they're non-governmental with these NGOs. But the fact is they do also endorse violence. If you look at, for example, the armed queer Salt Lake City head, who received accolades from U.S. State Department-funded NGOs and the United Nations, openly said, there's an incredible clip where she said, yes, we support violence. We support violent riots. That's how trans people won their rights with the Stonewall riots. They were violent. We need to remember that and be prepared to enact violence. Their recruitment banner has the phrase, the revolution will not be voted in. Join armed queers. They're calling for an armed revolution as a substitute for voting. I had a half-joking tweet where I said, you know, physics tells us that the fastest thing in the universe is the speed of light, but that's not true. The fastest thing in the universe is the speed at which the FBI would descend on a right-wing gun group that calls for an armed revolution as a substitute for voting. The fact is because these groups have been tools of state interests and of billionaire interests for a decade now, they have gotten a get out of law enforcement free card. The way domestic extremism or domestic terrorism has been defined by our Department of Homeland Security, by our FBI, by our intel services, presupposes that it can only come from the right wing, and that there's not even such a thing as an organized anti-fascist groups, despite their closed-door meetings and multiple burner phones and organized Twitter accounts and organized Discord channels and mass distribution of hundreds of clubs and riot shields and bricks and arson materials at every instantaneous pop-up riot they do. Despite it having institutional support from the professor class, the civil society and NGO class, cover from the media every single time, and zero action by federal law enforcement for a decade about this. Nobody on the right would dare to say what like Destiny came out and said this week about, actually more people need to die and get shot in the face so that conservatives fear showing their faces in public. That is an open embrace of terroristic violence, and nobody in a decade on the right wing would dare to say 10% of that, because they know the speed at which their life would become a Truman show. Every new friend they meet would be a federal agent from a different office or bureau. Everybody would shun them because they would know they're a Fed. And what scares me is when I hear them say that, I don't think they're feds. I think they haven't had the fear of the feds put into them. Because the crazy groups on the right that did this a decade ago, these like Adam Waffen type groups, they were infiltrated and neutralized so fast by federal law enforcement. So I don't want to hear a damn about, oh, you know, this is a weaponization of government, when this was exactly what was done and it achieved exactly what they said they wanted. The fact is you got to cut the money. You got to declassify all of this. I want to know every single global network that's been instrumentalized for this purpose. And I want to know if that factored into the decision by federal law enforcement to protect these groups at every level for the past decade. Charlie Kirk is dead, and we have a right to know now.
Amen. Mike, freaking dynamite. As always, brother, thank you. I have some final thoughts next. I love my cell phone company. I love having a cell phone company that I never have to worry about. Because here's the thing. I had, before I switched to Pure Talk, I had T-Mobile. And I remember we had to go to the mall. It was time to get my kid a phone, replace a phone. I forget what we were doing at the mall, but there was a T-Mobile there in the mall. And we went to the mall and walked right up to the door, and there's a big old pride flag slapped right there on the door. And I remember feeling about that high that I pay for that. I pay for all that filth, all this corporate America filth, AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon. We pay for that. You can switch to Pure Talk and never have to worry about your cell phone company again. You'll never wake up to a rainbow flag, maybe an American flag, never a rainbow flag. And you'll pay way less, not a little less, way less. Switch. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. They make it easy. Time to switch is now. Well, that was a lot. Told you it was going to be a great show. We have to continue to have these conversations and understand their methods, understand what we're up against. And it could be difficult because, as we talked about, as Mike laid out, it's all covered in layers of lies, layers of cover here and legal cover there. We just have to understand how these communists infiltrate. Just remember, that's the most important point, the one I made in the beginning. They see themselves as infiltrators, as revolutionaries, and that's why they operate the way they operate. We'll do it again.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.